Okay, and let me share my PowerPoint. Okay, so does everybody see? Thumbs up if you can see and hear well. Good. Perfect. Okay, so we're beginning our series, and our series is called Exploring the Jewish World of Medieval Provence, Creativity in the Chaos, a Medieval Jewish Provence. Now, before I begin, does anybody know anything about Provence? What Provence, where Provence is, what it refers to? Any ideas?
It's a province.
It's a province, right? Provence, province, that is correct. It's it's a part of France, as I'm going to show you in just a minute, that the Romans conquered. And after conquering it, they called this part of France, it was Gaul at the time, they called it Provence. For province, right? It's the same word. Okay, so let's begin. Where is Provence? So let me just note to begin that what is referred to as Provence nowadays is different.
Bad thing for Israel.
Is different than Let me just before I begin, I'm going to try to mute everyone and just so that inadvertent verbal disruptions. Don't disrupt the flow. But if you do want to say something, please feel free to. Okay. All right. Back to the share and we will continue. Sorry about that. Okay. So if you look at this map over here, we have a map of France. Provence, as you see in the map, is where my cursor is in the bottom right of your screen. Hopefully you can see that. However, when we talk about Provence in Jewish sources, they're actually referring to a much greater area. It's the southeastern region of France. So if you see my cursor, I'm trying to sort of make a circle around it. It even includes what you see here is called Languedoc. It includes places such as Montpellier, Marseille, Avignon. I don't have the best French pronunciation here, so pardon my lack of French, I'll say. But that's the region we're talking about. To give you a little bit of a better view, now you see a bigger map. This is from Google Maps. And I sort of charted out, if you were to travel through what was Provence back then and where you would be going through. Again, it's a pretty sizable portion of what is now southeastern France. Okay, so that is the geography. You'll notice that it borders pretty closely to Spain. Now, and that's important because Spain and France are both centers of Jewish life in the medieval times during the Middle Ages. And that's the region we're talking about. I hope that's clear. Okay, but before I continue with my slide, I want to ask you, where do you think is the first place that Jewish life is mentioned in France? Or how early do you think Jewish people migrated to France? Any guesses? To give you thinking about important times in Jewish history, say the destruction of the temple is in the first century CE, the second temple. You think about the Middle Ages, which we're talking about. So we're talking about the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. You think about the expulsion of Spain in 1492. So when do you think that the Jewish community first got to France? Any thoughts?
13th century.
13th century. I would have thought like you, right? The Middle Ages. Most of what we know about Jewish life in the Middle Ages, is from that time period. You would think that around then. Any other thoughts about when the Jews got to France or Germany? Or France or even Spain?
Rashi.
Rashi, great. So we'll get to Rashi in a minute. Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, may be the most prominent commentator on the Bible and on the Talmud, lives in northern France, right? He lives up here, somewhere up here, in what we call Troyes, spelled T-R-O-Y-E-S, for most of his life. We're actually talking about southern France, but Rashi is in the 11th century. So let me tell you that we actually know that Jews got to France in the first century CE, immediately after the destruction of the Second Temple. So this is a long time, a community with roots, Jewish roots for millennia. And believe it or not, I just found this fascinating. It is possible, even likely, that the French community is even referred to in the Bible itself. Could you imagine that? Jews in France, right? We think of the Bible, we think of Jews maybe in, obviously in Israel. We think of Jews in Bavel. But we even have a record of Jews in France, or at least a prediction. So I'm reading to you now, if you, hopefully you can see the slide, from Ovadia. Ovadia is one of the Treyasar, the 12 minor prophets. And Ovadia is talking in his speech in the period of the destruction after the first temple. Okay? So we're talking about, say, you know, 500 BCE or something like that. And Ovadia, in this, he has a very short book. And in this first chapter, he's actually predicting how the Jews who had been exiled are going to return to Israel and conquer their lands once again. He's actually speaking to the kingdom of Edom, and chastising them that you might think you're successful now, but ultimately you will not be. And for our purposes, I'd like to focus on this verse, which is in chapter 1, verse 20, and he writes as follows. And this exiled host of the children of Israel, who are among the Canaanim. Okay, so now we're talking about Jews who go into exile among Canaanim, Canaanites. Okay, as far as Sarephat, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sipharad. Just stopping here, what does the word Sipharad remind you of?
Spain,
okay, great. That is what we call Spain nowadays. But what else, when you think about Jewish people and Jewish communities, what when you hear the word Sipharad?
Northern Israel.
Sorry?
Northern Israel.
Sorry, can you repeat yourself one more time? Is that?
Tzfat, Northern Israel.
Tzfat, okay, so Tzfat. I know Tarshina spoke about Tzfat, but now we have a resh, an R in there. Sfarad. Okay? Anything else? What, when you think about Sfarad or Sephard, what do you think about? So we have Ashkenazi, Spain. And we have?
French.
Right, French, Sephardim. Sephardim. Right? Sephardim comes from the word Sfarad. The word Sfarad is mentioned in this verse. Where, right, and shall occupy the cities of the Negev. So Ovadia is making a prediction that these Jews who went to exile as far as Sarephat and as far as Sipharad will ultimately return to Israel. Where are these places? So if I brought you Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, who was mentioned before, who is going to be relevant to our discussion as we continue, but is not in the region of France that we're going to focus on. He reads as follows. He says the exegetes, meaning he calls them the parshanim, those who, he's quoting a number of scholars, claim that Sarephat is the kingdom called France in French. If you look in the Hebrew, he actually spells it out, like pei resh nun tzadi. This refers to France. And Sfarad is Spain. So I just found this very interesting that this prophet is predicting the exilees, the Jews who went into exile and basically formed the Ashkenazic and Sephardic communities that we know today. And of those communities, he mentioned Sarephat, which is what Rashi is telling us is France. So already in the biblical era, there is a prediction of Jews migrating to France, a very ancient history. When do we have Jewish presence in Provence? So,
do you know the etymology of Sarephat?
Where that etymology of Sarephat?
Yeah,
I don't know. I think it's a place. I don't know if there's
because it's not, it doesn't sound like the word France. So
doesn't sound so similar. That could be. I think the names of places sometimes do change. Yes, Esther.
So Sarephatit, when we say we speak French. Sarephatit is French.
Right. So certainly nowadays, Sarephat refers to France in modern Hebrew. That's without a question. The question is, when you refer to Sarephat in the Bible? Is it the same Tsarfat that we have nowadays? And Rashi here is telling us that yes, it is. So fascinating. I just found this fascinating. So how do we know about the Jews in Provence? So the story is that we don't have that much history, meaning there weren't historians writing, focusing on the Jewish community in Provence. Unfortunately, who do we hear most about the Jewish people in France and in Provence from? We hear about them from Christian historians detailing the persecution that they suffered, right? So for instance, the earliest record of Jews in France I have here for you in the slide is from St. Hilary of, I'm not even sure how to pronounce that, Poter, I imagine. Why? He's praised for running away from the Jews. Running away from the Jewish community because, you know, hanging around Jewish people as a Christian is dangerous. They may influence you. Then we don't want you to do that happening. So he's praised for running away from the Jewish community of France. And similarly, Gregory of Tours, a 6th century historian, writes at length about the different enactments that persecuted Jewish people in terms of, you know, what type of property they owned, in terms of wearing a badge they had wear, identifying them as Jews, right? This is really as Christianity spreads, after Constantine makes Christianity the religion of the Roman Empire and it slowly spreads, there's an obvious rivalry between the Jews and the Christians in terms of competing stories about who the true Israel is. And this does result for centuries in persecution in France and elsewhere, right? So it wasn't that great for the Jews in France for centuries. It was a difficult time. I just gave you, if you want to read more, there's a link there. I got much of my information from the Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 5. So this happened for centuries. Again, we don't have that much. Number one, generally, we don't know that much about the Jews during what you might call the Dark Ages. We don't know much about society in general during the Dark Ages. And we don't know much about the Jewish community during Dark Ages, right? We have biblical history, you know, which goes, let's say, to the Second Temple period. We have the time of the Mishnah and the Talmud. But between the Talmud and the Middle Ages, we have less information. But we know that they were there, that they were in France. Okay. Then we get to the 12th century. 12th century, the 1100s in France. And things, although not perfect, in 1096 already, there was a pogrom relating to the Crusades. But in the 12th century, I don't want to focus too much on the persecution, right? Because, you know, I want to focus on the beauty of the community. So in the 12th century, things get a bit better. There's a newfound, more favorable attitude toward Jews. And it's also very pragmatic. The Jews are good at farming. They're good businessmen and businesswomen. They are entrusted in playing a role in the agriculture. And they're appointed as bailiffs, okay? Bailiffs means that the lords, the counts who owned all of this land, who had the wealth, entrusted the Jews to manage it for them. So you can imagine, right? You know, can you imagine the difficulty in being a bailiff, right? Because on the one hand, you know, you have to do a good job in maintaining the lord and count's property, because, you know, that's your job. But what do you think might happen if Jews become too successful? What's going to happen if the Jews acquire all this land and all this wealth and all this property on behalf of the counts? Say again?
They're going to say they stole property.
Yep.
They'll accuse them of thieving.
Yep.
Thievery.
Yep, 100%. So it's always a very precarious balance between, you know, being too successful but not, or, you know, being successful but not too successful, and trying to make a name for ourselves, but on the other hand, you know, trying to keep a low profile. This is the story of the Jew in the Middle Ages. But relatively speaking, as compared to places in Germany and other places, the Jews, you know, because as we know, you know, what happened to the Jews in Germany? We know about the Crusades, right? The Jewish communities in Germany were really suffered tremendously. But the Jews of Provence in this southern area of France enjoyed a bit of a respite from the persecution. And I brought you here, and in this context of thinking about this, on the one hand, being under the dominion of these Christian overlords, but at the same time, given a certain sense of independence, a certain autonomy, it's an incredibly fruitful period of Jewish history in the community, and also scholarship, new attitudes toward learning, toward studying the Bible, toward studying law, and toward secular disciplines as well. I brought you a quote from Benjamin of Tudela. Does anybody know who Benjamin of Tudela was?
Explorer.
100%. Thank you. Yes, he's an explorer. Thank you, Mark. So Benjamin Tudela is known in history, not just Jewish history, but as he was a Jewish explorer who made a trek from Spain all throughout Europe and even to Asia. And he's actually, some of the earliest records we have of history in Asia are from his travels. It's called The Itinerary of Benjamin of Tudela. And he describes what he found in those lands, and specifically the Jewish communities he found in those lands. So if you want to know about Jews in the Middle Ages and the 12th century, it's a good idea to look at The Itinerary of Benjamin Tudela. Now, Benjamin Tudela is in Spain, and one of the first places he travels to is Provence. And this is one of he's describing here the community of Lunel, right? Which is a very important community. Many rabbinic scholars came from Lunel. And here's what he says to give you a look of what it was like during that time period. He says, the students that come from distant lands to learn the law are taught, boarded, lodged, and clothed by the congregation. Right? So what is he describing? What type of students is he describing here? Students that come from distant lands to learn. What do you think he's describing here?
Hospitality.
Warmth and hospitality. 100%.
For the students.
Students? What would you call that?
A yeshiva.
Yeah. 100%. Yeshiva. It's yeshiva. Right? So what he's describing here is people coming to learn in yeshiva in France, and the community is incredibly hospitable, which tells you what about the community if they can afford to be hospitable.
They have wealth.
Yeah, they have the money to do it, right? You're not going to house yeshiva students from a foreign land unless you can. Apparently they could, okay? And he says, the community has wise, understanding, and saintly men of great benevolence who lend help to all their brethren, both far and near. The congregation consists of about 300 Jews. May the Lord preserve them. Okay, so not the biggest community by our standards, but still benevolent, saintly. So we see here a community of very pious individuals, men and women who are dedicated to tradition and maintaining it, and also are very kind and benevolent toward others. So as you can see at this point, it is a good time, what you might call the golden age of France. That's not a historical term. That's what I'm calling it. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to do that.
Golden age.
You'll
of
see me?
Learning.
You'll see the PowerPoint? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It's always hard to navigate the sharing and the little thing on the top, but what can you do? So what is going on in the intellectual world of Provence? These are some of the things that we're going to explore over the next few weeks, beginning today, okay? And this is why I call it chaos and creativity. On the one hand, it is a time of incredible creativity and scholarship, new ways of looking at learning, at studying, at understanding the world develop in Provence. But as you can expect, whenever there's an ovation, whenever there's a new way of thinking about things, what's going to happen? What happens when someone comes up with a new idea? What happens?
There's going to be opposing forces.
100%.
People disagree.
100%, right? So people are going to disagree. They're going to say, how can you do that? That's not tradition. You know, we're a bunch of Jewish people. What can we do if not argue about our tradition, right? Isn't that what we do all the time? And it happened. It happens today. It happened thousands of years ago as well. And it happens in Provence in the 11th century. So I want to briefly here review or go over some of the new innovations that were happening and frame some of the controversy. Okay, number one, in terms of biblical exegesis, how do we interpret the Bible? So has anyone ever heard of the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi?
Yes, yes.
See a few, thank you. So Rabbi David Kimchi is a very classic biblical commentator. We have his commentary on the book of Genesis, the book of Bereshit. We also have his commentary on the most of the prophets. So, and he's one of the Rishonim. The Radak is from Provence, right? 11th. And actually, we have Rabbi Yosef Kimchi, who is his father, and then Rabbi Yosef Kimchi has the Radak and Rabbi Moshe Kimchi. That begins in Provence. Now, what did they bring to the table in terms of their approach? So instead of simply looking at the text and bringing whatever philosophical, or not philosophical, whatever worldview you had just from the words itself, they brought a new grammatical focus to studying the Bible, which to me, you know, is sort of the more technical aspect of it, but really trying to understand what the words mean, what the, how to conjugate words to get at the root of the word, the shoresh, what tense it is, and even comparing it. This is a new thing, which if you look in the commentaries, you might even take for granted, but this is a real innovation, comparing Hebrew to Arabic to get a better understanding of the words of the Bible if there's a word that's hard to understand. Right, that begins in Provence. Okay, that's in terms of studying the Bible. In terms of Talmudic methodology, okay, so do we know what the Talmud is? Right? Yeah. So the Talmud is, to describe it in one sentence, it's essentially a record of dialogue of the rabbis who lived in Babylon and in Israel during, from the early, I mean, late first century CE to the early fifth century CE, right? It's a record of dialogue about Jewish law. But if you've ever looked in a Gemara, if you've ever looked in a Talmud, what does the Talmud have in it? Does it stick to simply, this is the law? Of course not. It's back and forth. It's questions. It's answers. It's stories. It's popular sayings. There's medicine in there, there's culture in there. Everything, every genre is in the Talmud. Now, thinking about that for a second, okay? What would be the difficulty? What would be complicated about getting to the bottom line, Jewish law, from the Talmud? If I have a work which is made up of a dialogue. It's not simply, this is what you do in this situation. This is what you do in this situation. Instead, the Talmud is discussion. It's a question. It's an answer to the question. It's an aside. There's tangents. There's stories. And I want to know what practically I'm supposed to do. What's my challenge going to be?
It coming to the bottom line. It's not a law book. Sometimes they don't come to a resolution.
100%. So Mark says, you don't need to sometimes, first of all, there's so much material in there. What do I actually do? Practically, like, what do I do? Right? Like, how do I actually act in my life? What type of drink can I use to make kiddush? What type of prayer should I say daily? These are all discussions that go back and forth. It's entertaining. It's intellectually stimulating, but I also need to know what to do. And how do I parse out all that material, which is educational, but doesn't relate to practical living as directly? So in already, this is from Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, known as the Rif. Okay. He begins the movement to sort of parse out the legal elements of the Talmud and isolate them and issue rulings. So you have a discussion in the Talmud. One rabbi says this, one rabbi says that. They argue about it for three pages, right? Bottom line, what do? You look in the Rif, he'll quote you the bottom line. This is the law, this is the halakha. where Provence comes in, many Talmudic scholars in Provence, instead of simply explaining the Talmud as is, focus on the work of Rav Yitzhak Alfasi, focus on the Rif. So it's almost a certain secondhand analysis. It's analyzing a work on the Talmud to arrive specifically at halachic conclusions, okay? Now, here's where this controversy starts, and it's all in Provence. Some spend their time explaining the Rif, explaining what Yitzhak Alfasi meant, trying to defend him, understand how he learned the Talmud. However, Zerachya Halevi, who was one of the rabbis, the Chochmei Provence, the sages of Provence, the sages of this area of France, constantly argues and disputes the Rif's conclusions. So he's arguing on the Rif, while the other rabbis are defending the Rif. What do you think happens when that, if that's going to be the case, what do you think happens? Well, I'll tell
different
you.
Different answers.
What'd you say, AJ?
Different answers.
Different answers.
And no what? Resolution until the Shulchan Aruch.
Yeah, so it's back and forth, right? That's the way that Jewish learning, it's one rabbi says this, one rabbi says that, they're defending each other. But do you think they said, you know, hi, I saw what you said and I really appreciate your thoughts, but, Oh, it is ugly.
Yeah.
Provence specifically, between, we'll read it, next week we'll focus on Rav David, Rav Avraham ben Ibn David of Pasquer. He is a defender of tradition. He vehemently defends Rav Alfasi and vehemently attacks the Baal HaMa'or, the Rav Zerachya Halevi. So that's in terms of Talmud. Maybe even more controversial was another development, which was the development of philosophy and a new openness toward secular knowledge. Now, this is where we get to the influence of Spain on the community of Provence. You know, I'll even go going back to the map for a second, okay? I'm just going to go back to the map for a second. You know, so you see here, we have France, we have Spain on the bottom left of your screen, and we have southern France and northern France. So I'm going to throw out a question here. Historically, we know we have the community of Sfaradim, the community of Ashkenazim, right? The Jews from northern France and Germany, and then the Jews from Spain, okay? Which community do you think was more open towards secular knowledge?
The northern.
Spartic.
Okay, let's go with a hand. Who thinks the Ashkenaz, northern France?
I would have said
I think the Sephardic were influenced by the Muslim, who were the pioneers like for astronomy and things like that.
100%. Sorry, I know your screen says iPad 3. Can you remind me of your name, please?
Rose Romani.
I'm sorry about that. Thank
Just
you.
Just say Rose.
Thanks, Rose.
I'm the Sephard, by the way.
Okay, so you're in luck. I mean, I imagine that you're happy about this. So Mark is 100% right. The Islamic kingdoms of, you know, Spain and the surrounding areas were open towards secular knowledge. And many of the, as well, I'll mention, many of the, you know, later middle, the works of the Middle Ages on philosophers such as Aristotle are Islamic scholars. And they had an influence on the Jewish community. And so people like the Rambam, right, who we'll get to,
yes,
Maimonides.
Exactly, yeah.
Nachmanides were familiar with science as well as obviously incredible rabbinic scholars. In northern France, it wasn't so. In northern France, most of what we call the Tosafists, right?
The grandchildren,
the Baalei HaTosfot, were very opposed. Were very opposed to secular knowledge in general. And specifically philosophy, as we'll get to. But now you have Provence.
Well, Rambam was a physician. He actually was a physician. He wrote the treatise on asthma.
Correct.
Actually.
Correct. So then you have Provence. Provence is in the middle. So it gets fun and controversial and chaotic. So I'm going to move back to my slide over here. Sorry, before we get to Ramosh or Darshan. So number one, how do we approach these philosophical texts? So it's worth noting, already not in Provence, the Rambam. We have philosophical works emerging from the Sephardic Jewish community. The Rambam, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, right? The Rambam writes, the guide for the perplexed. Rabbi Sadia Gaon writes, Emunot Vedeot, the book of beliefs and perspectives. You have the Chovot HaLevavot from Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda, right? Another Sephardic scholar who writes a book called The Duties of the Heart. These are all very important works that get to the inner core of Judaism, what we should think, what we should believe, the types of people we should be, but they're also heavily influenced by secular philosophy. And they're written in Arabic. The Guide for the Perplexed, although we have today many translations of it, the Guide for the Perplexed and the Chovot HaLevavot, Duties of the Heart, are written in Arabic. Comes along the, I think I'm going to slide too far, the Ibn Tibbon family. Has anyone heard of the Ibn Tibbon family? Mm-hmm. So there's a family of called the Ibn Tibbon family, led by Shaul Ibn Tibbon, and then maybe even more prominent, his son Shmuel Ibn Tibbon, and they make it their business to translate all of these Arabic, Judeo-Arabic philosophical works, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Chovot HaLevavot, to translate them into Hebrew. So now they're accessible to the communities who don't speak Arabic, such as the communities in southern France and eventually northern France. Okay, so they focus on translation and making philosophy more accessible. And it's not just Judeo-Arabic works, it's even secular works. Shmuel Ibn Tibbon translated the works of Aristotle and Averroes, right? Based on the Islamic authors who also, you know, wrote commentaries on their works, right? But they're making philosophy more accessible and scientific works as well. So there's a new openness toward secular knowledge and philosophy in France, okay? And it's also a new orientation toward Judaism, a philosophical approach, right? So when I read about a commandment, I don't simply ask, what should I do to fulfill the commandment, but what else do I ask? Not just the what,
why?
But why? 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 What goal? What philosophical goal or what idea is God attempting to bring out from this commandment? Which, as you can imagine, we'll get to this hopefully next week in a few weeks, but is a bit of a risky proposition, because once I start asking the question why, it's more speculative. And if I make use of philosophical speculation and to interpret the Torah and the mitzvot, it's a Pandora's box, as you can imagine. So in that vein, you know, we had traditionalists in Provence who were not so pleased about this newfound openness and accessibility of philosophy. And I'll mention too briefly now, and we'll get to this later. But so we have, as I said, the Ra'avad, Rabbi Avram Ibn David of Pasquer, writes a critique of Rambam's Mishneh Torah. Right? So the Rambam is an innovative thinker. The Rambam comes up with this brilliant idea. If you know about the Mishneh Torah, building on what Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, Rav the Riv did, the Rambam went even further and he organized the whole of Jewish law and living, in his opinion, into 14 books organized topically, which sounds great, right? Here's the problem. A few problems. Number one, the Rambam did not write his sources. The Rambam did not say how he knows what he writes. He never says, you know, I got this from the Talmud, I got this from a Midrash, I got this from this rabbi, he just writes it. Okay? So that's number one. Number two, he had a lot of innovative ideas. You know, the Rambam is pretty well accepted nowadays. He was a controversial figure. as we'll get to in later weeks. And he pretty vehemently attacked some of the rabbis who were earlier than he was. And so the Ravid
and
attacked Rambam.
His Jews burned his books, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's what we'll get to. We'll get to that. Yeah. And that opposition that Mark speaks of, Jews burning his books, starts in Provence. And that's where we get to Rav Shlomo of Montpellier, along with Rabbi Yonah ben Avram Garondi, okay, Rabbeinu Yonah, known classically, and Rabbi Shlomo, Rav Shlomo Minahar, known Minahar is the Hebrew appellation for Montpellier, right? From the mountain, a Mont, a Har, right? So Rabbi Shlomo Minahar issue a ban on the study of philosophy, and not just philosophy, but even in the studying the works, the philosophical works of the Rambam. So the Rambam wrote the Guide for the Perplexed. He also wrote the first book of his 14 books on Jewish law and life. Jewish life is called Sefer Hamada. It's the book of knowledge. It's less focused on practical details and much more focused on ideas, you know, what we know about God, what we believe about God, what we believe about revelation, right? And those types of ideas. And there was a lot of opposition to it because a lot of it is based on philosophical ideas that come from outside the world of Judaism. So there's a lot of controversy, a lot of chaos, but a lot of innovation. I think hopefully I've painted that picture. So we're going to talk about all of this as we move forward. And today I want to start with one particular scholar who's a little bit less controversial, but I still think very important. Before that, let me stop for if anybody has any comments or questions at this point. Everybody with me?
I just want to say one thing. You know, Rambam was actually born in Egypt, I think in Alexandria. So he was actually really Middle Eastern. I mean, that's why I guess his writings were in Arabic. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows that, but
right,
as an FYI.
Right. Okay.
He only landed up in Cordoba later.
Okay, beautiful. Any other thoughts? Okay. Let's continue then. Let's continue.
Rabbi, what is Renel in Provence?
Sorry, what'd you say? A map. Miriam?
Where is Renel? This place, Renel, that you mention all the time.
Renel, you said?
Yeah, Renel. L-U-N-E-L.
It's where is it? Good question.
It's not on the map.
Yeah, well, if you look closer in the map, you know what? Maybe I'll send you an email of where you might find it. You can look for it. You can actually look for it in on Google Maps today. But let me here. Going back to the map. One second. Going back to the map for a second. If you look. One second. So I believe it's around over here.
I never heard it mentioned before.
Yeah, so there are actually a lot of important rabbinic scholars from there. Asher Miluniel, Rav Yonatan Miluniel. They're the Talmudic scholars specifically. But yeah, it's an important community in Provence.
Does it still exist today?
So there is a place called Lunel. I don't know. I'm not sure that the... But there are... I mean, as you may know... while France was what used to be one of the biggest Jewish communities, even more recently there's been a lot of persecution there, and it's been difficult for Jews there, and there's been a lot of migration out of Provence specifically. There are very few Jews that live there nowadays, but the place is there, right? Like, so that just not really a Jewish community. Okay. So let's talk about our first scholar that I want to meet, and that is Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. And Moshe HaDarshan is a very early rabbinic scholar. One thing that just fascinated me about him, just in terms of how long ago he was, this is a scholar who predates Rashi, right? So we're talking early 11th century, maybe even the 10th century. Most of the rabbis we know about are from 1100s, 1200s. And Moshe HaDarshan is early. Now, before I continue, does anybody know what the word Darshan means?
From Doresh, Lidrosh.
Yeah, Lidrosh. What does that mean?
to ask for something, to want to have something.
Yeah. To ask for something, okay.
But it's like the exegesis, like it's sort of delving.
Exegesis.
So I'm going to call it a preacher, right? Where Moshe, so what's fascinating about Moshe Darshan is that he has the word Darshan in his name, meaning he's known as Moses the preacher.
Oh, okay.
He's called the preacher, okay? Now, when you think about someone who preaches, what type of message are they going to do? Or how are they going to read the Bible? And what type of message are they going to give? What do you say? When you think about a sermon.
Musser.
Okay, yeah. So, Musser. So, what'd you say?
Inspiration.
And that is why I think Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan, we'll see, had a very new way or creative way of looking at the biblical text. And because when you are looking to give an inspiring message, you have to be innovative in how you look at things. It's not always so easy to, you know, read things simply. So that's a little bit about Moshe HaDarshan. We know very little about him. Actually, if you take a look over here, I gave you the cover of this book by Hanan Elmach, who's an Israeli scholar, historian. He wrote a whole work on Moshe HaDarshan. It's literally like it's like solving a mystery. It's like detective work, like taking all these different times where he's mentioned in passing and putting the pieces together to sort of put together his life. That's the type of thing he does. In that vein, he tries to put together a picture. He's known as, I said, preacher. We don't know much about him. We know he's often associated with Narbonne, Chachmei Narbonne. That's one of the regions in Provence I showed you before. And which it sounds like we have written material from him, but it sounds like the written material we have was delivered orally. He would go about and preach in the community.
Rashi yes. quotes him. Rashi quotes him.
Yes, I'm going to get to that. Thank you, Mark. Yeah. So in terms of biographical information, he's a son named Yehuda, who's also a preacher, maybe even a greater scholar than he was, Talmudically. And more, also important, he's the teacher of Rabbi Natan, son of Yechiel, who wrote the Aruch. The Sefer HaAruch is basically a Talmudic encyclopedia, meaning he has entries in sort of an alphabetical order. So he'll give you an entry I'm trying to remember one off the top of my head. If you look through it, he goes alphabetically and tells you what these things mean. And often halachic conclusions will emanate from them. I don't know. Maybe he'll say something like, if there's Shabbat, he would be in Shin, or more specific than that, like Borer. Borer is the, you know, prohibition against selecting certain things and sorting on Shabbat. He might have an entry about that. So he was the student, as far as we know, of Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. How do we have his work? So the other fascinating thing is we don't have today, there's no book written directly by Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan that's extant. We don't have his book. But as Mark mentioned, he becomes famous because he's quoted by Rashi, by Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. Rashi is an incredibly prominent writer. His work is disseminated throughout the Jewish world. Even today, you can barely read in a Jewish day school, you can barely read a verse of Bible without some sort of explanation. And Rashi's often who we turn to, or the Talmud for that matter. And he frequently quotes Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan. So we have his quotations of Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan from Rashi. He's also quoted by Don Isaac Bravanel, who is an important scholar in 15th century Spain. And fascinatingly, he's also quoted by a man named Ramon Marti, who is a 13th century Dominican monk. And he's not quoting Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan, you know, just to say a Dvar Torah to his church. He's often quoting him for polemical reasons, to sort of use his more creative, open interpretation for and muster his interpretations for arguments toward Christianity, which is possibly one reason why Rabbi Moshe HaDarshan's book did not become so widespread. There's a certain gap in the history of the study of his writings between the 11th and 15th centuries. maybe part of the reason for that is because, you know, his work, his midrashim, many of the midrashim we have are ascribed to him. And they're often used for polemics. Okay. So now let's look, I want to at least for the remaining time we have, and maybe the next time, I want to look at the type of thing that Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan would do. On this slide, you have in front of you a pretty, you know, straightforward description. Let me read what it says, and then I'll tell you what it is, and then let me know your thoughts about it, okay? So this is a description of the offerings of the Nisi'im, the princes. So every tribe had what we call a Nasi. Does anybody know what a Nasi was? Nasi is like the president of the tribe, essentially. You know, like governor, call it what you want, the prefect. You know, it's, I'm not sure what exactly they're, you know, it's sort of, they're the leader. I'm not sure what the typical or the practical role they had, but they're the leader of the tribe. And at the Torah in Sefer Bamidbar, in the Book of Numbers, describes how the Nasi'im, the princes of each tribe, upon the dedication of the Mishkan, upon the dedication of the tabernacle, gave a certain offering to the tabernacle, an offering, you know, sacrifices and presents and things like that. And what's fascinating is, maybe you know, what do we know about the offering of every single prince?
They're the same.
They're all the same, and yet the Torah repeats every single one in detail. And let me read this to you now. This is from Bamidbar chapter 7. Okay, so this is the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nachshon, son of Aminadab, of the tribe of Judah. His offering, one silver bowl weighing 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels by the sanctuary weight, both filled with choice flour with oil mixed in for a meal offering. One gold ladle of 10 shekels filled with incense. So we have a meal offering, a flour, and we have incense. One bull of the herd, one ram, one lamb in his first year for a burnt offering, one goat for a sin offering, and for his sacrifice of well-being, which we call a shlamim, or otherwise known as a peace offering, two oxen, five rams, five he-goats, and five yearling lambs. Lambs that are 1 year old. That was the offering of the Nachshon, son of Aminadab. And then it says the offering of the prince of Shimon on the second day. And it says the exact same offering with all the details, how many rams, how many sheep, how much the spoon weighed, how much the bowl weighed, and the incense. And it does this again and again and again and again. And that this takes up numerous verses in Sefer Bamidbar in the Book of Numbers. Now, what do we do with this? What question would you ask about this
selection?
Why? Okay, that's always a good question. Thank you, Rose. Why is a great question.
If the Torah generally is so careful about not using extra words, and we often learn halachot from one letter, why do we have this 12 times?
Right. So that's one great question. Why repeat it 12 times? But what about within this? What about just within this one chapter? What might you ask? I don't know. Like, why do we... Do we really need to know all this stuff? Is it really important, like, how much the bowl weighed? Right? Like, so it says one silver bowl weighing 130 shekels. Well, let's say it was 120 shekels. How would that have changed the way I live my life? Like, why so much detail, so many numbers that seemingly have no meaning, okay? So I think that's a legitimate question to ask that emerges from the text. We have this problem. The problem is, I'm not going to focus on repeating the Nasi, the same thing 12 times. You know, there are a lot of answers to that. Each one had their own intention. You know, maybe it shows that you can do the same thing and five people can do the same thing, but they can think about it and approach it in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. I want to focus on the numbers. So that's Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. So we're going to read a selection of comments of Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. We're going to read his comments on these numbers. And in the end, trust me, it's going to say numbers Rabbah, which is a midrash, a number of times. But he's quoting Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. You'll have to believe me for this, okay? And you'll see it at the end, okay? So let's take a look. Number one, Kara Aratz Kesef. There's some Hebrew there because we're going to use something we call gematria. Gematria means when you take the numerical value of the letters. So the Hebrew alphabet begins with Aleph. Aleph is 1. Bet is 2. Gimel is 3. And so on and so forth until you get to Kuf. Kuf is 100. Resh is 200. Shin is 300. Tav is 400. He takes the numerical value of these words and ascribes meaning to them. So let's take a look. So there's a silver bowl weighing 130 shekels. Okay. Ki arat kesef. If you take the words ki arat kesef, the numerical value of its letters is 930. I'm not going to do this every time, you know, because there's only so much addition I can afford in one lecture, but I did it for you. Kuf is 100. Ayin is 70. Resh is 200. Tav is 400. That's 770 with the word ki arat, which means bowl. Kesef, 20. Kuf is 20, Samach is 60, Pei is 80, it's 930. And I invite you to do all the math yourselves if you want to challenge Rashi. I'm pretty sure we got the math right. Okay, why 930 corresponding to the years of Adam HaRishon, Adam the first? So it's Karat Kesef to correspond to Adam HaRishon. Okay, and this bull weighed 130. Why 130? Well, because Adam lived for 130 years until he had Shate, you know, until he had Shate, who was the son that continued his lineage. We're leaving aside Cain and Abel for now. His lasting son was Shate, Seth, and that he had at 130 years old. It weighed 130 shekels because 130 years old was when Adam had Shate. Moving on. One silver beaten of 70 shekels by the sanctuary weight. I think I missed something here, actually. Okay, I think I did miss something. But, okay, so why, sorry, Mizrak Echad Kesef, okay? A silver bowl. If you add up the words Mizrak Echad Kesef, you know, the numerical value, 40 plus 7 plus 200, you get 520. Why is 520 important? I'll tell you why. Because Noah, we talk about Adam, okay? Noah had his children at the age of 500. And the 20 is 20 years before the Mabul. Okay. Or 120 years before the Mabul. And also before 20 years after the decree was made. Okay. Shivim shekels, 70 shekels. Is the 70 nations. The 70 nations of the world, there's this tradition in Jewish thought, there are 70 nations of the world. Noah, after he gets off the ark, brings sacrifices. Those sacrifices are on behalf of the 70 nations of the world. That's why it weighed 70. Continuing. Why one spoon? A kaf. Kaf echat means one spoon. Kaf. The word kaf in Hebrew also means a hand. It's an allusion to the Torah, which was given from the hand of the Holy One. And that one spoon weighed 10 shekels. What is 10 always? 10 is the 10 commandments. And it's milei ketoret. It's filled with incense. If you add up the word ketoret, it's 613. It's not. It's not actually. So there's a trick. Because there's something called atbash, where you can sort of switch the first and last letter of the alphabet, the second and second to last letter of the alphabet. And so if you switch the kuf with a dalet, it's 4. And if you switch, so then you get 613, right? So pretending the kuf was a dalet, resh and tav is 600, tet is 9, switch the kuf for a 4, 613, 613 commandments, beautiful. So kaf echat means one hand, it weighed 10 because 10 commandments, the numerical value is 613, that's why the numbers are here, right? Okay, moving on, one ram, one bull, right? And one lamb. Why? The bull, the bullock is for Avraham. Avraham, why? Because he took a young bull. This is in 20 for during the Brit Bina Bitarin, the covenant of bull, the parts. Right? So that's Avraham. Ayel Echad, why one ram? Because of Yitzhak, because of Isaac. Because God, Abraham took a ram instead of sacrificing
Isaac. The sacrifice.
Right, 100%. Why one keves? Why one sheep? Oh, obviously, for Yaakov. For Yaakov. Why? Because when Yaakov meets Esav, he separates sheep. He separated other animals too, but we'll keep that sort of quiet, right? Okay, and we go on. Why 2 oxen, 5 rams, 5 he-goats quickly because I know we're running out of time. Okay, there are 3 species, 3 types of species. Why? So it's 2 of them. So it's Moses and Aaron who worked to make peace between their father in heaven and the Jewish people. It's 3 types. It's the 3 divisions of the nation, priests, Israelites, and Kehuna. It's also the Tanakh, the Pentateuch, which is Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. And so we have, and that's why it's 3 different types. Why is it 5, 5, and 5? Because there are 5 books of Moses and 5 commandments on each side of the tablets. Beautiful. And the last line is, as I have here in the bold, thus far have I found in the work of Rabbi Moshe the preacher. Okay, so Rashi has this list of gematriot, this list of numbers and their significance. And I know I'm a bit over time, right? Let me just finish up quickly. And who did he get all this from? Moses the preacher. As you may note in the slides, the copy I got this from quotes by Midbar Rabbah, which is a midrash. Based on this, many ascribe that Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan wrote Bamidbar Rabbah. Here's the question, right? What in the world does any of this mean? Like, what's he doing? Really? Oh, so the 5 is the 5 books of Moses. You switch around the numbers a bit, it's 613 commandments. What's the point of this, right? That's the question, okay? So to say it briefly, I think what he's doing, we'll elaborate maybe a bit more next time, then we'll talk about the Ra'avad. He's trying to make meaning out of text in the Bible, which also otherwise might not be meaningful. And I think he's making connections, right? This is the establishment of the tabernacle, okay? This is the realization of God living with the Jewish people. And Rabbi Moses, the preacher, is looking at these numbers. He's trying to tell you a message about the significance of that. How, number one, he connects it to Adam and Noah, the beginning of time and their children. That this is a development throughout human history, from the beginning of time, culminating in the establishment of the tabernacle. He connects it to the Torah for 2 reasons, I would argue, and you could discuss it among yourselves. Number one, because the tabernacle is a mobile Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is divine revelation. The tabernacle is where God reveals himself to the Jews as they travel through the desert and where they keep the tablets they got at Mount Sinai. And so he connects it to Revelation. Avot, Moses and Aaron, keeping in mind the leaders who are our forebearers, our forefathers and foremothers, and the leaders who brought us to this point. And finally, the people, the priests, Levites, and Israelites. That all of this beautiful revelation, this beautiful structure, right? All of this is contingent upon the Jewish people themselves. So I know I said that pretty quickly, but I think the point is it's a new creative way of interpretation in order to allow for new meaning and to make connections to send his audience a message. And that's a new, it's an art form, right? It's preaching, but it's preaching based on the text with a certain poetic and creative license to make important connections so that the reader gets a profound meaning from a text which otherwise might be inaccessible. And that's part of what Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan contributed to the world of biblical learning. Okay, I'm going to stop here. Briefly review, we talked about Provence, we talked about the history of Provence, when Jews got there. We quickly framed the different controversies going on, new approaches toward learning, a new openness toward secular knowledge and how controversial that might have been. And we discussed a bit about Rabbi Moshe Hadarshan. I apologize, I'm 3 minutes over time. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Thank you.
Hope to see you next week as well.
Thank you.